If you've been told to pull up your socks recently, then make sure it's a pair of RCR socks. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/shop.
Welcome back to the dialogue with Diwa de Boer on Reality Check Radio, where we discuss politics, power, and culture. You can text your thoughts to us on 2057 or email questions and comments to inbox@realitycheck.radio. We're joined now by James Viggiano, a New Zealand Bitcoin advocate with a background in traditional finance. We'll ask him about Bitcoin, cryptocurrencies, digital money, and how the government and banks work to make your money worth less. I will add a little disclaimer here as well to say that this segment here is not financial advice. We're talking here about Bitcoin, about digital currency, about the politics of this, but I'm not here to tell you what to do with your money. So I'll give you that disclaimer and welcome to the show, James.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me.
So the first big question is just going to be a very, very broad one, and I'll let you run away with it. Simple question, what is Bitcoin?
Yeah, it's a great simple question, but I could spend an hour talking about that. In a couple of words, I describe it as digital savings or unspent capital. When people use the word Bitcoin, they're usually talking about two things. There's Bitcoin, the technology, the protocol, which is this open source code base that anyone can run on their computer. And then there's Bitcoin, the units of the currency within the network that it creates.
And how many Bitcoin are there? I think a key thing to note that's quite important about Bitcoin is the limited supply versus, say, other currencies where somebody controls how much of it is in circulation. So how much Bitcoin is sort of in circulation and who controls the supply of this digital currency?
Yeah, that's a really good question. The way I like to think about Bitcoin is that there's only one Bitcoin, the protocol that we run. And it has a distribution schedule where if you divide that Bitcoin up into 21 million units, we happen to also call those units Bitcoins. But nowadays, we use an even smaller unit called the Satoshi or the Sat, where there's 2,100 trillion of those. The way Bitcoin works is that the protocol sets out that we're all agreeing to this one kind of fixed plot of land, and we're dividing it up and unlocking it over time. The only way that Bitcoin enters circulation, the only way, even the founder and creator had to do it this way, is that you have to earn the Bitcoin by providing what's called proof of work. Proof of work is basically a way to pay for the Bitcoin by proving that you've expended real energy in the real world. That's one of the technologies that Bitcoin relies on for its distribution. So in terms of how much is distributed now, we're 15 years into this. It started in 2009. Well, the white paper came out in 2008 at the peak of the global financial crisis. It started in 2009. And if you divide the one Bitcoin up into 21 million pieces, the 21 million little Bitcoins, we're about 20 million into it by now. The rate at which it unlocks and gets distributed is something that cuts in half every 4 years. So most of the distribution happens at the front end, but it still distributes for the next 50 or so years.
And in order to sort of unlock more Bitcoin, the miners, as they're called, have to keep working. Is there something else that these miners do as well? When all the Bitcoin is mined, how's the network going to keep on going? Like you've mentioned, hey, it's been around for 15 years now, which I think has helped. Like I've kind of been aware of it since the early days, and people are cautious about new technology, and often rightly so. And you get early adopters who are really excited about it, and the skeptics and the critics, and you can sort of see, you know, whose predictions work out and whether or not that the technology is stable, whether or not the promises are kept. What does this look like, you know, going forward for the next 15 years, the next 30 years, 100 years? How does Bitcoin keep going forever, if it does?
Yeah, so we call them miners because when we try to explain Bitcoin, we like to think about it like they're mining for gold. But there is no mining happening. There's no environmental impact happening. They're actually just data centers. And these data centers are now at such a large industrial scale where they they're basically providing an immense amount of demand response support to the electrical grid in places like Texas and Kazakhstan and Russia. What happens is their incentive to keep providing this proof of work, and when they do that, they're cementing the history of transactions in the blockchain. Their incentive for doing that for the last 15 years has been that piece of Bitcoin reward that gets unlocked. But as you mentioned, eventually that reward, or we call it the block subsidy, that reward runs out and goes to zero. That's a key value proposition of Bitcoin. That's how we, as the people who run the Bitcoin protocol, are keeping it scarce, making sure there's only one Bitcoin, preventing it from the supply being expanded and all of our holdings being diluted. So the thing that keeps miners going as the block subsidy cuts in half every 4 years is the transaction fees. They go directly to the miners. So when you do a transaction on what we call the base layer, which is the blockchain that Bitcoin secures, you are effectively settling final settlement of the new kind of base capital of a new financial system. And so the theory is that over time, the transaction fees on that layer are going to increase, and that provides enough of an incentive for the miners to keep on mining. I say mining, but I mean just to keep on using electricity to secure the network.
You're right. They kind of do difficult computations, basically. I remember years ago, there was big, you had real trouble getting GPUs, like graphic processors for your computers or your gaming PCs, because all of these people were buying them up to run difficult calculations and doing the computations for the Bitcoin network. Now, you mentioned the energy situation as well. I think that's something that's often raised by people saying, oh, Bitcoin uses up tons of energy. And I guess what kind of energy is it actually using? You hinted at that with the grid in Texas and Kazakhstan and so on. Is that basically it's a surplus energy that, you know, the electrical grid is always creating energy even when people aren't using it, and that basically gets wasted, right? And Bitcoin sort of is a solution to that, if I understand this correctly.
Yeah, so these Bitcoin data centers, they're actually probably the most socially responsible user of electricity you can have in your grid, because they are able to provide something called demand response. They don't have an end client. So the electricity that they're paying for, that they're contracted to buy, they, at any point in time, are very happy to stop using their electricity and let the grid have it. So when you have these winter storms where there's a surge in demand from retail users turning on their heaters all at the same time, you can't get the TY Point aluminium smelter to turn down its usage precisely to match that spike in demand, but you absolutely can get a Bitcoin data center to do that. And they very much want to do that because they are purely for profit. And if they're making more money letting other people have the electricity, they'll do that. In terms of the generation that they are buying, the way Bitcoin data centers, the industry works, is that it's extremely competitive and they're all racing to get the lowest price per kilowatt hour of electricity. What that's led to is they're providing massive baseload demand for this huge excess renewable surplus generation that lots of places around the world have. We technically have it here with our giant hydro dams in the South Island. We have this giant hydro dam producing a huge amount of electricity. It's like 10 or 20% of the New Zealand's electricity, but you don't have a population around there to use it. And so the only way to have built that dam in the first place, the only way to have raised the capital to do a huge capital intensive investment into electricity generation, was to line up a big buyer who will agree to buy the electricity for 10, 20 years. And so we partnered, as New Zealand, we partnered with Rio Tinto to do that with the aluminium smelter. And now we're seeing an industrial user like that does have emissions, whereas an industrial user like Bitcoin doesn't. And so the next generator that we want to fund and build, whether it's offshore wind farms, another hydro generator, another geothermal generator, we can now, the energy companies who want to build that can fund that and show a contract with a Bitcoin data center who's willing to be that baseload and buy that energy for the next 10, 20 years and provide flexible demand response. So when the grid has a surge in demand, they cut their consumption. So it's basically Bitcoin data centers are enabling places like Texas to massively overbuild their generation capacity, more electricity than they could possibly consume. And in the meantime, instead of having high curtailment costs, we've got nowhere to send it. They're selling it very cheaply at 2 cents, 3 cents a kilowatt hour to those Bitcoin data centers. And then when their grid and their cities and their township grows, those data centers sell it back.
This actually sounds like a very good solution to the problem that we had just a week or two ago with the polar vortex, winter storms in New Zealand, and the grid kind of was felt like it was crippled. And you get all these warnings, people need to turn the electricity off. And that doesn't happen very often. It doesn't happen very often that that things get really, really cold here across New Zealand. Like it's a few days a year, maybe, where you need extra electricity. And then there's a big calculation that people need to do. Okay, well, do we just tell people to turn off devices they don't need because it's only a few days a year? Or do we build massive amounts of new generation capacity? Do we spend billions and billions of dollars building more electricity that just doesn't get used 360 odd days of the year?
Yeah. And so Bitcoin helps with that second part, especially when it's green renewable energy, you're not doing any environmental damage. But there's an alternative solution that's competing with Bitcoin data centers, and that's the gas peaker plants like Chesapeake in the US, where if you have a surge in demand, why not just burn some more gas to meet that demand? So there's different solutions in the market with different emissions profiles. So it is funny to me that environmentalists, for some reason, are labeling Bitcoin as not being green when it's very clearly an awesome green solution to help our grid become greener.
Well, this is great. We haven't talked about how to make money yet here. We've just been talking about the technology and the electrical grid. It's actually a fascinating part of the Bitcoin network and how it's changing the world. Now, people are often confused with Bitcoin and cryptocurrency. So what is cryptocurrency? How is it different to Bitcoin? And like, what, you know, if the listeners on the radio here who know nothing about this, what's really important for them to know about cryptocurrency versus Bitcoin?
It's a really good question, because if you ask someone who's into crypto that question, they'll tell you they're the same thing. If you ask someone who's into Bitcoin, they each have different ways of explaining it, but I'm going to do my best shot now to explain why Bitcoin's different from cryptocurrency. So cryptocurrency is a broad term. It can mean a lot of things, but what it generally means is the tens of thousands of these, what I call unregistered security tokens. Basically the equivalent of shares in a company, except when a company tries to sell shares to the public, there's a regulated process where they have to open up their accounting and show their books and show if they're making a profit or a loss and then be accountable to their shareholders. An unfortunate consequence of Bitcoin being this awesome decentralized global pool of capital is that people are trying to scam you out of your Bitcoin. And so there's no barrier to entry to spin up a little crypto token and market it to Bitcoiners and say, give us your Bitcoin, and you can in return get this little token, and it's going to power this app or network. And I'm not trying to say that all of them are scams. I'm sure that out of that ICO, they called it the ICO craze, which stands for initial coin offering, very similar to the IPO craze that happened in the dot-com bubble. The long story short is that Bitcoin is the innovation. It's the scarce decentralized money, the capital, and cryptocurrencies, they're also into Bitcoin. It's just, there's this funny saying, they're into Bitcoin, but they're actually into your Bitcoin. So when people are promoting Bitcoin and talking about Bitcoin, we're not that interested in things you can spend your Bitcoin on. You can spend your Bitcoin on anything, and sure, you can invest it in these startup companies and take this high risk with it, but just understand that it's a much bigger risk than just holding the Bitcoin itself.
And as I understand it, often with many of these different cryptocurrencies, they're not decentralized in the way that the Bitcoin network is, where you've got no one player that you know can sort of cripple the network. Many of these cryptocurrencies, like I said, they're started up by a specific person or a specific company to serve a particular task, maybe. And there's a lot more risk there for people, because somebody can pull the rug, somebody can sell all of their initial holdings and crash that sort of seems to happen. People talk about the scam, people buy into it, and the original guy who started it, he sells off all of his assets, basically, and everyone else loses their money.
Yeah, like you've got it exactly right. And you can see that happening so we talked about proof of work and Bitcoin data centers, and that's really what's keeping Bitcoin decentralized. Every holder of Bitcoin had to earn their Bitcoin, and just holding a large amount of Bitcoin doesn't give you any more influence than anyone else over the protocol that's protecting its scarcity and its fixed supply. By contrast, the most popular cryptocurrency is probably Ethereum. They have a system called proof of stake, which is basically shares. The largest holder of the Ethereum, the largest stakeholder, like the largest shareholder, can make decisions that change the fundamental principles of the protocol. So that means they can be like a central bank where they suddenly expand the supply and dilute existing holders. And that's actually what they do with their proof of stake reward mechanism. So exactly what you said, Bitcoin's unique in the way that you're not going to be able, there's no one that can rug you, as you said, rugging. Yeah.
And now there's one other, I guess, part of this digital currency network that seems to play an increasingly important part. I mean, I looked at a chart recently that said basically stable coins, and these things are called stable coins, are now the majority of transactions or money that's being held in the entire sort of digital currency, cryptocurrency plus Bitcoin market. So what is a stable coin, and how is it part of the system? And as well, how is it different to like a generic cryptocurrency token? What makes these stable coins stable and seemingly more popular with people?
That's a good question. I like to say that the term stablecoin is a misnomer, because I am from the worldview that fiat currency isn't stable. I think that over time it loses its value. But the reason it's called a stablecoin is because its value is pegged to the value of a fiat currency. So here in New Zealand, it's a New Zealand dollar stablecoin. It'll be something that is meant to be pegged to the value of a New Zealand dollar. The most popular one in the world is US dollar stablecoins. And within that group of companies, the most popular by far is something called US dollar Tether. The way it works is actually quite simple. They work with Cantor Fitzgerald in the US, and all they do is when you give them US dollars, they buy short-term government bonds in the US. The institutional investors have known about how to do this for a long time, and it's called a money market fund. But now this product, this US dollar Tether, brings that exposure to a money market fund down to the retail level and at the microtransaction level, where you can have a dollar of Tether. What a deposit with Tether versus a deposit with JP Morgan have a different risk profile. A deposit with JP Morgan is fractionally reserved. JP Morgan doesn't have that dollar to give all of its depositors if they all tried to withdraw at the same time. And JP Morgan operates a little bit like a casino, where it takes risks with that money and lends it out. Tether, on the other hand, again, this is not financial advice because Tether is not regulated, so it's actually a bit harder to audit this, but they work with Cantor Fitzgerald, and the idea is that every dollar of deposit with them is actually going straight to the government. This trend, this popularity in stablecoins, is happening at the nation state level, with the New Zealand Central Bank is looking into doing it itself with what's called the Central Bank Digital Currency. But they prefer to use the term digital cash, and I agree that digital cash is a better way to describe it.
So you mentioned central bank digital currencies, or CBDCs, they're currently called. And we actually get quite a few questions about that on the radio. People want to talk about these digital currencies. Is the government kind of trying to take away actual cash and have more control over people's lives? So the big difference in between basically a stable coin and a central bank currency is who's in charge of it. And is the New Zealand digital dollar, I believe, is run like the stable coin, as we call it, is run by Easy Crypto. Are you aware of how that's regulated in New Zealand as well, differently to the US, or does it work very similarly to how it works in the US regulation wise?
So it's probably unregulated, and that's one of that demand from depositors so in New Zealand, we've been raised to think that a deposit in the bank is, you know, safe, but it's actually a loan to a company. So the central bank recognizes that, and it's trying to provide us with a way to cut out the middlemen and hold our deposits directly with them. At the moment, you deposit with a commercial bank. There's a small select group of people who are authorized deposit taking institutions. There's like 10 or 12 of them. You deposit your money with them. In fact, you don't have a choice. Usually your income has to go to a bank account. They take that. They give you a small amount of interest in return, and they can give it to the central bank themselves and earn the official cash rate at the moment, which is 5.5%. So they make this free margin. It's this subsidy that we are providing the banks basically as the public. The idea of central bank digital currency is to cut out these middlemen. So if the US went for a central bank digital currency, they would be trying to cut out Tether, basically, but also try to get the public to understand that their deposits with a bank like JP Morgan, or here in New Zealand, their deposit with Kiwi Bank, is taking a risk, and that bank should offer you a return for it. It's a financial instrument. And so the landscape is changing, where I think I like to explain it a little bit like how what we did with the fiber internet in New Zealand. We had a monopoly on the internet where the telecom was the retail service provider and the infrastructure provider. And then we ripped out the infrastructure and separated the business. And now we have a bunch of different retail providers, and we have the government help support the infrastructure rollout of fiber. We're doing a similar thing with taking the deposit base from these Australian and New Zealand banks and giving these depositors the ability to deposit directly with the central bank. And so it's kind of like that becomes the cash equivalent, and it's cash in the sense that it isn't a liability. The company that you have it with, you'll still be able to access your CBDC through Kiwi Bank, for example, but it will be an account that Kiwi Bank can't be touching themselves. It's actually with the central bank, the money. Yeah.
So it's a question then for people kind of who do they trust? Do they trust their bank, or do they trust the I think people see it in terms of, I guess, seeing the government, like that is government money. Is the Reserve Bank, because it's technically supposed to be sort of independent from the government, right? If the Reserve Bank has the central bank digital currencies, you have your cash with the Reserve Bank directly. What are your risks? Are they able to cut you out as well? I guess that's a big concern for people. And then is there no longer any privacy for how they spend their money? Like people will say, well, they want to work with actual physical cash, and then they don't have to worry about their transactions being tracked and recorded. So is this potentially the end of privacy for people? And is that a legitimate concern? And are there other risks other than privacy? Like, is it privacy is the trade-off, but everything else gets improved?
Yeah, I think I have a unique take on this as a Bitcoiner, because a lot of Bitcoiners are very scared of CBDCs. My view is that if cash disappears, even just for practicality reasons, if people stop wanting to use cash, but they still want to do private transactions, there is no chance that's going to happen from the commercial banking sector, because that's already completely surveilled by the US, the Visa and MasterCard and all that. That's not private, that's public. Yeah. The scope of the research that's going into New Zealand's digital cash, there's a huge emphasis on privacy. And there is this invention called Charmian eCash that does allow a custodian, like a central bank, to give its users a cash-like product while also blinding itself to how they're transacting with each other. That invention actually does exist, and it's becoming really popular on Bitcoin. People are doing it now with Satoshis, those little units of Bitcoin. They're putting them into things called Fedi Mints or Fedi, or another thing called Cashew. I guess I'm trying to say that digital cash, even if it's centralized, can offer privacy, or at least an improvement of privacy than what you're going to get from the little cartel of commercial banks that currently control deposits.
And then another concern then, as well as a, you know, can the central bank delete your money? Kind of, can the Reserve Bank take your money away from you? I mean, there's already a concern that you'd have now with the commercial banks, so they close your account and take your money. People will have dealt with that anyway. So do people rightly see the CBDCs as making this worse, or do you actually think that, hey, this is actually going to be a safer thing for people?
This is a great question, and I am personally a victim of debanking. So I've been debanked about 6 or 7 times by the commercial banks. So when government provides a service, we control the government as the population of New Zealand. So we put into law that the service must be provided equally to all New Zealand citizens. So that's why everyone in New Zealand can go to the doctor and get free healthcare. With the digital cash the central bank's going to provide, it's actually going to offer you the protection that you can't be debanked. If you can't open up a commercial bank account, those financial service firms are private. They don't have to extend you credit. They don't have to let you use their services, and that's fine. If the government steps in now to provide that public service that they can't debank you from. But in terms of the technology, because it is digital, when you compare it to their current version of cash, which is paper, absolutely, it's possible that they might be able to make it more programmable. They probably want to make it open up the programmability of it to let different financial service providers do their own way of programming it. But the big kind of fear is that if you have programmable cash and it's all controlled by one central entity, So if you have a one world CBDC, like if the dollar takes over the world or the yuan or whatever, it will probably be the dollar. If you have a one world CBDC, what if they start doing policy decisions that discriminate against people? They start censoring people's payments, like, oh, you've hit your alcohol limit for the month, you can't buy any more alcohol. Well, honestly, that's probably going to happen, but that's where private money, Bitcoin, fills its purpose. And you can't censor your Bitcoin payments. And there might be an advantage to having the other side of the coin, which is censored money, CBDC, because that's money that maybe they are distributing to try to get objectives, like they might be providing people with, you know, single income solo mothers with support so that they can go buy kids their clothes, and they could program into the money that you can only use this on food and clothes for your children, for example. But to be honest, I don't think that's the direction we're going to take the development of our digital cash in New Zealand. So we're not the one, we're not the one world global CBDC, you know, this scary kind of thing. Mm-hmm. We're a small little country actually trying to protect our sovereignty and protect our ability to make the policy decisions over our money. And so our digital cash is probably going to be very private, very easy to transact, hopefully uncensorable, but you also have easy access to Bitcoin for when you want to use free market money. And so it'll be interesting to see how it develops.
Yeah, that sounds very interesting. And you're right in that you have a unique take on this compared to all the conversations I've had with people. Actually very insightful for me to hear your thoughts on this. And I hope that the audience agrees. And also if they've got questions and comments, please, if you're listening, send those through to us, inbox@realitycheck.radio. Now, we talked about the fixed supply of Bitcoin, basically, and we know that fiat money, your regular cash, doesn't have a fixed supply. The government can create more of it, sort of, I mean, you say printing money, sometimes they don't physically print the money, but sort of by loaning out money, they sort of create more supply. This is something that kind of drove the philosophy of Bitcoin, was to counteract the government and the banks diluting the money supply, reducing your purchasing power. Are government-controlled digital currencies going to make that worse, do you think? Like, does it make it easier for them to print money? Does it not really make a difference? Is the rate of devaluation roughly going to stay the same? And does that remain Bitcoin's strength?
Yeah, it's a really good question. It's like debasing the currency was a policy decision. It was a very intentional decision to do it. And the government wants to retain that power, and it wants it to be the New Zealand public who elect the people who make those debasement decisions. In New Zealand, it was about 50 billion that the central bank printed digitally out of thin air, just in their ledger. They created an extra 50 billion and they gave it straight to the government. I say straight to the government, but they did it via that little cartel of banks so that they get their cut. And so it doesn't look so dodgy, but it is us printing more dollars. So yeah, Bitcoin, definitely the origin of Bitcoin is a response to central banking. It's a response to how our trust in central banking always gets broken. If you're a millennial, you've experienced this a lot now. In 2008, they printed money to bail out the banks. They'll do it again. They printed money to bail out the pharmaceutical industry. They're bailing out the military industrial complex. But yeah, that's exactly right. When someone has the ability to expand the supply and devalue the units, more likely than not, there's always going to be some kind of emergency to justify that. And that's probably still going to be a part of our future for fiat currencies. And that's a real unique value proposition of Bitcoin. That's why Bitcoin, I call it savings, because it actually can provide that scarcity, that savings technology. If you keep all your savings just in the cash, the central bank isn't going to even allow you to do that. They're going to put a cap on how much of the CBDC you're allowed to hold. But if you kept all your savings in the CBDC earning no interest, you're just basically the one paying for all the debasement that happens, because it will lose its value over time. But the trade-off is the reason that the currency is manipulatable like that, they're trying to achieve some kind of stability where you can enter into financial contracts. If you're a business and you're selling coffees and you're buying milk and coffee beans, you might want to have it all, the accounting, quite simple, and have $1 in, 50 cents out, and make your 50 cents of profit. If you're just using Bitcoin natively, which a lot of businesses are starting to do, but if you're just doing Bitcoin accounting, there is still volatility to it. It is still the early years, and volatility can make business more difficult. And so there are reasons why people might want to operate in that so-called stable environment, even though we know over the long term it's consistently devalued and the central bank gives us their target of 3% per year, although that's more like 10% lately, but they tell you they're going to debase it. You just don't use that balance for your savings. That's your hot spending cash.
Yeah, I guess in high inflation environments, which there are some around the world today, if you read the stories of what people do, it's they get the money and then they spend it right away because in the next month, it's going to lose 10% of its value or 20% of its value. So people are very quick to spend it. And certainly I find that when you're talking to people who are dealing in Bitcoin, very much thinking like the opposite way, like, oh, if I hang on to this, it'll be worth more. So I don't want to spend money. And I guess in the way the economy works, the financial system works, like encouraging people to spend is considered to be good for the economy, considered to be good for the GDP number. And like you said, it causes inflation. And this is why younger people are much more concerned. Like, I can't afford a house anymore because of inflation and food's more expensive. Everything's getting worse and worse. And so there's a lot more interest from people to find ways, especially younger people, to find ways. Like, how can I take my work and store it in some way that I can use it in the future and it's not, you know, kind of counteract the inflation that we're facing.
That's exactly right. So when you have a currency that's being regulated based and that's causing inflation, because the money that's being spent is new money that wasn't paid for by anyone, it was printed out of thin air, that dilution of everyone's money devalues everyone's currency and it causes people to take more risks with their money. The moment they get their paycheck, they try to invest it in something. They punt it on the stock market or they lend it to some highly leveraged banks in a high yielding interest account and the bank goes under. So it creates worse decision allocations of capital when you don't have the ability to just save it and lock in that value. And so that's what Bitcoiners are thinking about when they are buying Bitcoin. They're not taking a punt on Bitcoin and hoping it goes up. They're not taking all their money at once and buying it. They're taking a portion of their paycheck and they're tithing, they're dollar cost averaging into Bitcoin, building up their stack of, you know, their little plot of land, their fixed share of this fixed amount of land. And New Zealanders have actually known this for a long time that you shouldn't keep all your savings in the bank. That's why most New Zealanders are actually betting against the value of the New Zealand dollar when they take out a mortgage and they buy a real asset like land and property. So the mindset is of the Bitcoin is very similar to that, but it's a property ladder, you could call it, or a property that you can get in with $1. You don't have to save up. As a millennial, we all kind of got rugged where we entered the workforce after the GFC, started saving our money. And when it came time to buy a house, the house prices doubled. And our deposit that we'd finally had enough to buy a house suddenly could only buy half the house it could a year earlier because of that sudden debasement that happened in 2020. And so this allows people to actually have a savings account that can't be rugged.
And yeah, I guess over time, like, what's the value of Bitcoin over time? You look at the charts and ignore the volatility and look at the trends, and you can see, especially when plotted against the fiat currencies, that if you're putting money into Bitcoin 10 years ago compared to putting it into the bank or the stock market, things, you know, are going to look very different for you today, and hopefully that can hold true into the future. But what are some of the problems with Bitcoin as well? And now's a good time to get into some of those. Now we've talked about the technology side of things. One key difficult thing that I don't think is fully solved yet is the problem of keeping wallets safe. How do people keep their Bitcoin safe and without losing it? Because everyone's got a story that they know someone who lost money because of even just a mistake or a misunderstanding of how the technology worked. So if you got some advice, then without getting, say, no financial advice, but say someone's got Bitcoin, got a wallet, how do they keep it safe? How do they stop? How do they avoid situations where they end up losing this? Because it's not like, again, like the bank where they are supposed to be doing all this stuff in the background and they've got all these people working and the money is technically safe. You're actually responsible with Bitcoin. And that makes things, you know, much more risky, much more dangerous for people.
Yeah, it's a good topic because maybe people will start to view banks a bit differently when it's not guaranteed that they'll be bailed out. So with Bitcoin, the financial system with Bitcoin at the base layer, this new financial world that most young people are participating in, there's the full range of custody options. If you want to, you very much can use a Bitcoin bank. That is where you're trusting someone else to keep your Bitcoin safe for you. The difference with Bitcoin versus government fiat currency is that it's a lot harder to take self-custody of your savings when it's in fiat currency, because you don't want to have a suitcase full of cash in your house. Not just because they debase the cash, but because it's a physical security threat. Someone could run in and rob you. Bitcoin gives you the option, if you want to take custody of your Bitcoin. And there are a variety of tools to make that even securer. So if anyone in the audience has ever had a corporate bank account, you do a thing called multi-signature, where if your business has three directors, the bank is only authorized to make a payment when two out of three directors provide their signature that they authorize the payment. Bitcoin has the exact same technology, but you can spin it up yourself. You can create your own wallet that has a two of three multi-signature setup, and it could be yourself, your partner, and a family member who lives in another country. Those could be, or it could be a third-party service provider. So it's kind of like there are custody options in Bitcoin. There's a full spectrum. You can let someone else have full custody of it and spread it out amongst a bunch of them in case one of them loses your Bitcoin. Or you can do collaborative custody, where a service provider holds your hand along the way. They hold one of the keys to your Bitcoin. You hold the other key to your Bitcoin, and you have a backup. And there's different setups you can do, but you're absolutely right that right now it might be a bit overwhelming to a new user. There is a solution when, hopefully this is happening soon. There's a thing called federated custody. So instead of just trusting your Bitcoin to one custodian, like one bank, all of the banks in New Zealand can form what's called a federation. There's one that exists already called the Liquid Federation. That's a federation of all the Bitcoin kind of exchanges, not all of them, but a large group of them. When you have federated custody, it means that the Bitcoin you have with KiwiBank, for example, you're not even just trusting it to KiwiBank that because they might lose it. You're actually trusting it to the entire federation of banks. And you'd need, let's say it was 12 banks, you'd need 9 out of 12 banks to all collude to steal that Bitcoin. So there are solutions on the market. There is technology available to make it more accessible for more users. But yeah, the general recommendation, if you want to take self-custody of your Bitcoin, is to get something called a hardware signing device, a hardware wallet, that will keep your little private key signature on it, and it will be separate from your computer, so people can't use the internet to hack it. And then to learn about multi-signature, where you and your family members, you can each have your own little hardware wallet, and you can put some Bitcoin in a pool together that requires a majority of you to be able to spend it.
As you can hear, it's still a technologically difficult situation, and I've definitely found that with dealing with family members and so on. There are some solutions that are, I guess, fairly simple when it comes to like wallets on your phone, and it's okay, you've got 12 words to keep safe, and people can sort of understand that a little bit. But of course, that works only when you're dealing with very small amounts of money. Like once you start dealing with larger amounts of money, suddenly it feels like, oh no, you don't want that on your phone. And so you're giving good examples here for cases where people are dealing with larger amounts of savings. But yeah, my advice, I don't know what, I'll let you give some advice too. I guess my advice to people there, not financial advice, by the way, but if I'm dealing with people directly, I sort of say, start small, like start with something small and take your time. And it's been 15 years, take it slow and don't put all your eggs in one basket, or don't try to get into something you don't fully understand. Take the time, like a little bit of skin in the game, just a little bit, and then do more learning and experimenting and figuring out how it works without getting yourself into trouble with technology that you don't understand.
Yeah, absolutely. Like I recommend to people when they're getting started today. So there's this whole new social network called Nostr. It's not a network, it's a protocol. So there's hundreds of new apps people are using. So if you're already out there putting content out on the web, like Instagram photos or TikTok videos, share them on Nostr and use just a simple custodial Bitcoin-only wallet on your phone. I'm not endorsing any of them, but some of the ones that I personally have tried are Albi and Blink and Wallet of Satoshi. Basically, these are Lightning wallets that allow you to open up the pipes and let the little bits of Bitcoin start flowing towards you. They are being held by a custodian, but that could be your first, you know, the first few cents of Bitcoin that you earn on the internet. It's okay that you're accumulating it with a custodian. And once you start to accumulate more and it becomes worth something serious, like once you have a couple hundred dollars or $1,000 worth of Bitcoin, you'll then have the very much incentive to think about, okay, I want to learn how I can withdraw this from the custodian and take it into my own custody and keep it safe. Or you just end up spending it. But yeah.
And so when it comes to spending, how do you spend Bitcoin in New Zealand? And is it something that people do? Like, I believe Bitcoin was initially supposed to be actually used as a currency, but more and more people, like you mentioned, will use it as savings. And what are the practical uses in New Zealand that you could point people towards to say, hey, actually, this is real money that you could spend if you wanted it to?
Yeah, that's an awesome question. So a lot of people say, oh, you can't use Bitcoin at the grocery store, so it's not money. Okay, that's fine. Let's park that idea for a moment. So Bitcoin allows tiny little micropayments to happen instantly across the world and uncensorable payments. And so the most common way that you spend Bitcoin today is every time that I like a post that I see, I like a piece of social media, I zap it. We call it zapping when you lightning bolt it some sats, because the technology we're using on top of Bitcoin is called lightning. So you zap some sats for the content you like, and immediately like 1 cent or a fraction of a cent worth of Bitcoin goes from you to the content creator. That little micropayment economy right now is growing quite rapidly. So people use Bitcoin every day for new types of payments that aren't possible with fiat currency. The minimum payment you can do with a Visa card is probably, to be honest, it's probably a dollar to make sense because of their transaction fees. But, you know, you're not going to get sub 1 cent payments with Visa. If you want to spend it at a physical store in New Zealand, there are companies now trying to help these stores to accept Bitcoin and then provide the conversion to New Zealand dollars for them so that they have very simple accounting. LightningPay.nz is something that's trying to do that, which is going to be awesome when that gets more adoption. But in the meantime, people usually just buy like a gift card. You can buy Amazon, Steam, all these kind of gift cards online with Bitcoin and then spend the gift card. But yeah, so Bitcoin is a store of value. And it's now transitioning into that medium of exchange phase, you know, realizing the dream of being money.
Yeah, I've also seen like credit cards from Visa or MasterCard. I don't know if those are available in New Zealand, but basically you, with them, you kind of hook up an account and they do all the conversions and you basically just use a credit card. I'm not sure how popular that is or how available it is in New Zealand, but all of these different technologies are coming a very long way. And you mentioned like zapping little micropayments through this protocol called Nostr. We're not going to have time to go into that. I actually don't know very much about it, and I would love to know more about it. So I'm going to park that. Maybe in a few months we'll get back to that, and we'll focus this back onto Bitcoin with, I guess, the privacy concerns again that I discussed around CBDCs. People say that Bitcoin has this problem as well, where the ledger is public, all your transactions are public, that it's not private. Is that something that you see as a concern, or is it purely because of the on-ramp and off-ramp? Like if I want to make a transaction into New Zealand dollars backwards and forwards, you have to go through a company that has know your customer regulations, and the money has to go into a bank account, and so all of that is trackable and traceable. Whereas maybe what you were describing with these other types of little microtransactions you're doing via Nostr, like those are truly, in a sense, untraceable. Maybe you can to tell me like if I understand it correctly, or there's a very different way that privacy works in Bitcoin's network.
I think you understand it, yeah. So at the base layer of Bitcoin, the transactions that happen on the blockchain, the one where you're paying those fees to the miners, those transactions, they're large settlements of Bitcoin. They're competing with the central bank settlement network, with the big corporations that are settling payments around the world. That's the type of payment that happens on the base layer of Bitcoin. We're fortunate that we're still early enough where we can all, if you're a sovereign individual, you can participate there too if you want to pay the transaction fees. It's transparent for a reason. We need to be able to audit the Bitcoin blockchain so that we can verify that the scarcity is being enforced, that no one is printing new Bitcoin out of thin air. And we do that, and by we, I mean people who run the Bitcoin protocol on their computer. Every 10 minutes, you're actually auditing the entire history of every piece of Bitcoin from its creation through to today and where it's been and where it's moved. Importantly, there's no names attached to the Bitcoin addresses. It's all pseudo-anonymous. So it's all a jumble of letters and numbers called public keys that you see. But if you voluntarily hand over your passport and driver's license to someone who's selling you Bitcoin, they could be tracking the Bitcoin. There are things you can do to try obscure that, you know, that person who's trying to spy on you, to stop them from spying on you. Within the Bitcoin industry, sometimes we call, it's called KYC or Know Your Customer. We like to joke and say that's the illicit activity, because actually that's really dangerous, tracking people's money. People have a right to privacy. So it's completely voluntary to use a service like that where you volunteer your information. But as you mentioned, the Lightning Network, it's actually a lot more private. And well, it's both. If you choose to use a provider like a bank to offer you this Lightning service, it's between you and the bank, the same way right now that the bank looks at all your payments. I guess one key difference is right now, not only is your bank spying on your payments, but the US through Visa absolutely spying on it too.
And some other, I guess, old objections with Bitcoin that I've seen floating around that perhaps you could address is like the creation of it. Is it truly decentralized and trustworthy? Like, was it, because it was created by somebody anonymously, was there maybe some secret backdoor or involvement by the CIA or some other intelligence agency or some other government? Like, someone's got some secret stuff that's going on, and the story at the very foundation of Bitcoin is sort of obscured, so that people think it's anonymous, but actually maybe there's some dark stuff hidden and somebody could hack the network in the future.
Yeah, so the CIA absolutely used Bitcoin. So every three-letter agency around the world uses Bitcoin for the same reasons that they use the internet. It's this technology that's been around long enough now, and it serves a purpose that I don't know how the CIA operates, but if they have an operative in a foreign country and they need to get capital to them, they'll send them Bitcoin. Or if that operative needs to get capital out of the country, they'll use Bitcoin, because you can't go through a banking system where you're completely KYC'd. So intelligence agencies use Bitcoin because everyone benefits from using Bitcoin. Bitcoin's for yourself, Bitcoin's for your enemies. What makes Bitcoin really special is that no entity can exert influence over it any more than you can. They can't change it. Now, to understand why that's important, you have to look at the open source code and run it yourself and see how the maths in the code works. And then you're happy with that not having a backdoor, and then you're happy with it not able to be changed to introduce a backdoor, you can go forward with confidence that there is no ability for someone to rug you.
Yeah, that's right. So everything that the Bitcoin network runs on is completely open source and available for anyone to audit and look through. So that is what, I guess, gives most people who are running the network and who've put a lot of value into it their confidence that they can be sure, okay, I can have a look at it and everyone else can have a look at it and it's fine to use. And also it requires quite a large consensus to change, I believe. So any kind of changes means that the vast majority of people who are running the various different nodes have to accept those changes, right? And that's how Bitcoin can still accept changes. Yeah.
And on that point, those changes have to fit within the existing consensus rules. So the existing consensus rules state that Bitcoin has a finite supply and the distribution of it will be through that halving schedule to the miners. If someone tried to change that fundamental element of it, my Bitcoin node, you know, I might be away on holiday, I might be in a coma, I might not look at it, it continues running the original code, enforcing the original protocol. The moment someone tries to make a payment using that new protocol with the expanded supply of Bitcoin, my node rejects it. Just immediately, without me having to do anything, that's rejected and it's not considered Bitcoin, and it ends up getting its own name. So this has been tried 10,000 times. There's lots of what's called forks of Bitcoin with people trying to do this. But if you're trying to change a fundamental principle of Bitcoin, like you're trying to introduce a backdoor, that's by default rejected. You don't even have to actively reject it. You just keep living your life, and that's not going to change Bitcoin. But if you want to make an improvement to Bitcoin, refine the scope and make it more intelligent or more programmable, you can do that within the existing consensus rules. And if enough people adopt and agree with that, it operates as a layer on top of Bitcoin without forking and creating a new currency.
And then perhaps lastly on this topic of objections and risks, going to zero, I still see some people talking about, oh, well, one day, what if Bitcoin is worth nothing one day? Like, how does that work? How does the price mechanism work? People say it's worth more because they plan to sell it off to somebody in the future. And what if you're the last one holding the bag? Are we at the point now where, like, Bitcoin is used enough that this objection can basically be be brushed aside. Like say 10 years ago, you could say, well, there's no serious person using Bitcoin. But as you've described in the interview already, like all these serious institutions using Bitcoin. So yeah. Maybe this is a deeper question, like what is value? Like that's a bit more difficult. What stops like the New Zealand dollar from going to zero is the fact that it's backed by the government, right? What stops the United States dollar from ever going to zero is the fact that it's backed by the United States military and so on. So things like that help to provide backing. But at the end of the day, what's really providing the backing to Bitcoin?
Yeah, so every bit of Bitcoin is bought and paid for with real electricity expenditure, real proof of work. And most of it's already in the hands of holders, but there's still more supply to come. And every time Bitcoin goes on sale and people are selling their Bitcoin, a lot of people do sit back and think, oh, it's going to zero. I'm going to step in and buy the rest of them when it's only a dollar each, because then I'll get all the rest of the Bitcoin supply. The reality is there's always someone with more money than you willing to pay more than you to buy the rest of the supply. There's enough collectors out there that it's never going to reach zero. Even just one of the largest Bitcoin holders has enough cash to bid $1 per Bitcoin for all the Bitcoin. That's only $21 million. Bitcoin is a $1 trillion asset. Let's remember that. You mentioned institutions. We didn't have time to touch on this today, but exchange-traded funds have just started exploding in the US, where the big institutions are now holding this on behalf of clients. And on your question of technological capability, if you don't want to be technologically savvy and do it yourself and you want to trust an institution to hold it, the idea in theory is that the regulated ETFs are meant to provide that kind of protection. It's whether it plays out in the long run or not clear, but at least now your KiwiSaver or your institutional investor, your pension fund, has a product that they can allocate capital to that secures the Bitcoin for you.
Yes, so this is basically a massive change that's happened in the last year. Perhaps I had a quick look just before to see, are there actually some KiwiSaver providers now in New Zealand that let you actually allocate into these Bitcoin ETFs, they're called. And supposedly, you know, the big institutions like BlackRock, they hold the actual Bitcoin, and all of this is regulated through the United States stock exchange and financial markets. So theoretically, when you retire in 30 or 40 years, you should get, you know, the value of that, and you can effectively save KiwiSaver to some small degree in Bitcoin, and that I guess is a massive amount of legitimacy to the network, for good or for ill. I think I've seen some controversial takes, like people are like, this is not really what's supposed to happen. But at the end of the day, that if you have these massive financial institutions and all of these regulations that are making these Bitcoin funds as part of the stock market, then it becomes at least as stable and as guaranteed as the stock market is.
Yeah, that's exactly the intention there. And you mentioned BlackRock. Interestingly, they haven't even figured out how to custody it themselves. They're relying on a third party called Coinbase. Fidelity, on the other hand, have spent a long time learning how to custody it themselves. So if you want to diversify custodians, that's interesting to look in that direction. KiwiSaver, controversial opinions on it. I like it. I call it the forced HODL, because if you're taking custody of all your Bitcoin yourself, between now and retirement, either you might lose it or you might be tempted to spend it. And I like spending Bitcoin. The advantage of having your own custody of Bitcoin is that you can spend it, but you do want to plan for your retirement, and sometimes diversifying and letting there be a forced HODL structure where you literally can't touch it to your retirement is good. But, you know, you're also putting your faith that the government will let you start spending it at some point before you're, you know, too old.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's the thing around KiwiSaver at all. It's like, am I ever going to get that money? There's entirely different risks. And one last reminder as well, this entire interview is not financial advice. Hopefully we've spent most of our time talking about the technology, and I've definitely learned a lot from you on this. And even though I've been studying this for, I don't know, a decade basically, and I'm not very close to it though. It's roughly kind of around the edges, and it's always nice to talk to someone who's focused on this day by day. So how do people follow you online? Are there real world places people can go to learn more and so on? Could you give us I'll give you an opportunity to give us a final wrap up.
Yep, I'm at James Viggy, V-I-G-G-Y on Twitter. And from there, you can learn more about Nostr, where I'm doing most of my social media posting. And if you want to meet me in person, I like to attend the BitKiwi meetups and the Auckland meetup that's happening this weekend. So there's a website. If you Google Kiwi Bitcoiner Guide, you'll find there's a bunch of resources geared towards Kiwis, and also a list of upcoming events where you can go meet a Bitcoiner in person, learn a bit more, you know, realize that if you're getting into Bitcoin, you might feel a bit crazy and a bit isolated because the whole world around you is not into it yet. But when you go meet a Bitcoiner in person, it's really good and you understand a bit more where people are coming from.
Well, thank you very much. That was James Vigiano, who's a New Zealand Bitcoin advocate who had a background in traditional finance. And I learned a lot today. And thank you. And I do hope we'll touch base with you in the future again on some of these different topics, because there's a massive amount of development happening in the technological sphere and in the financial sphere. And it's really great. Thank you, James, for joining us.
Awesome. Thank you for having me.
To the audience, we will be right back after this break.
Thank you for tuning in to RCR, Reality Check Radio. If you like what you're listening to or dislike what you're listening to, either way, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057, that's 2057, or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We would love to hear from you, so connect with us today.